Well, do turn back and have to Mark chapter 12, page 716. And it'd be really good if you could have that open in front of you over the next few minutes or so. But boys and girls, I hope that you were listening to what Andy said, because it's really important that you learn how to grow crops. Just imagine for a minute that you were a farmer and that you woke up one morning and you decided that the crops were yours to grow. All this lovely stuff that we see here, even the stuff inside the tins, at some point or other was grown on a tree, or this one was grown on a tree, or perhaps was planted in the ground or similar. So a farmer has made, has grown that and organized it. What kind of things do farmers do, if you were listening carefully, to make things grow? Where do they start? What do they have to get hold of, first of all? What's a farmer have to have just to start? Come on, somebody who's under 12. Sophie, you have to have seed, okay? Seed is one. Okay, something even more fundamental than that, even more important. Before you have seed, you've got to have some, what? Somebody else, come on, Joel. You're going to have soil, so you're going to have a field to put it in. So seed and soil. What else does a farmer do? Once he's got seed and he's got soil, what else does he do? You just had a lecture on it. Pictures. Come on, what else do they do? Somebody that hasn't answered yet. Go on, Daniel. Do you remember? What else does he do? Come on, somebody. How about that big thing that cuts holes in the soil? Come on. Oh, Luke, yeah. Water, yes, he has water, seed and soil and water. Come on, there's something else. What else do they do? Come on. Oh, Daniel, go on. He plows, thank you. Okay, so he gets the soil and he prepares it and he plows a hole or something like that. And then he drills in the seed. I actually didn't know what cultivating was, Andy. I thought cultivating was the kind of overall name for the whole thing. It obviously isn't. Talk to you afterwards. Am I the only one that doesn't know that? No. Oh, right. Richard will know. I know. Well, you can talk to Richard as well. Okay. So they get it all ready and then water comes and eventually it all... It's a lot of work, isn't it? And in the passage that Andy read to us just a few minutes ago, actually, there was a lot of work involved. So the farmer in Jesus' parable went to a huge amount of trouble. He wasn't growing grain like we saw in the combine harvester. He was growing grapes. He planted a vineyard. If you look at the passage, there's an enormous amount of effort involved in planting a vineyard. So the first thing that he did, I wonder if you spot it. Just have a look at chapter 12 and verse 1. He had his field and he planted the vineyard. That's the first thing. So, well, I mean, that in its own right looks like a huge amount of effort. Look, to get that vineyard going, he has managed to organize these stakes and to run trellises all the way along. Then he's planted the plants in the ground, and that must have been quite a lot of effort to do. And he's organized for water to go into it. And that's just to get them growing in the first place. He hasn't done anything with it yet. A huge amount of effort. And then once he'd got that going, what's the next thing that our passage says that he did? Have a look at chapter 12 and verse 1. So he planted the vineyard. Then what did he do? Somebody that's maybe 20 or under. Because apparently the others can't. Oh, Tom, you're not 20, but that's great. Go on. He built a wall. Thank you. He built a wall. Now, do you know what? It's very interesting. The reason I gather, having researched this extensively, the reason that they build walls isn't actually so much to keep people out. Because walls like that, and that really is a Middle Eastern wall, by the way, walls like that, well, you know, you can climb over that without too much effort. Do you know why they build a wall? Does anybody know why they build a wall around a vineyard? Sorry? Wind, that's exactly right. It protects the grapes and stops them from getting scorched. And once he dug a wall, what happened next in Jesus' story? So he's planted the vineyard, he's put a wall around to protect it from the wind. Then what did he do? He's excited now. Then what did he do? Caleb? He dug a hole for a wine press. Now that doesn't look much like a very impressive wine press, but it is. That is a Middle Eastern wine press. Does anybody know what they did with a wine press? shoes and socks off time is what they did. They would get, at harvest time, they would get the grapes and they would put them in the wine press once they'd been harvested. And I'm told in parts of Portugal to produce port, they still do this deliberately with unwashed feet. How about that? So that it adds to the flavour. They would stand and they would get squidgy. And it was a way for the young people of the town to earn money. Now, how do you fancy that, guys? Not working at Dutch Cottage. No, no. Or Tesco or Asda or wherever else the young people... No, no, no. No. Just being paid to go and squidge grapes. Anybody want to volunteer? At least what, Tim will volunteer. Just bear that in mind next time you need wine squidging. With unwashed feet as well, Tim, no doubt. Okay, and then he did something else. Now this next bit is a bit odd, actually. So he's planted the vineyard, he's put a wall around it, he's dug a pit, and what else has he built? Come on, read the passage, chapter 12 and verse 1. What else did he build? Someone who's under 20. What else did he do? He built something. A what? You're right, he built a watchtower. Thank you very much. He built a watchtower. Now, do you know what? In a vineyard, they still build watchtowers. All over the world, particularly in the third world, they still build watchtowers for vineyards. A watchtower, in fact, was almost the most important thing that you could put. If you wanted to know, as a family, where are my kids? Then you go up the watchtower and you can see across the vineyard. If you wanted to know, how's the harvest getting on? Rather than walk it like Andy does, if I just want to go and get a general idea of how everything's going, well, I can't see that at ground level. No, no, I go up the watchtower. If I want to find out where the workers are, which bit of my vineyard they're in, well, I go up the watchtower. If I need some rest, or I need some sense of protection, I go up the watchtower. If I need to store my supplies, my lunch or something, well, I can do it in the bottom of the watchtower. If I just need to have a moment just to step aside from everywhere, rather than be lost in the middle of the vineyard, well, I can go up my watchtower. Where should I go if a bear enters my vineyard? Well, I can go up the watchtower. If there are intruders, or where's the safest place for us to stand? It's in the watchtower. But I wonder if you spot it. All in chapter 12 and verse 1, this guy who's the farmer has gone to an enormous amount of trouble to build a vineyard and to build it right. He hasn't taken any shortcuts. He's gone to a huge amount of trouble to get it just exactly as the very best vineyard could possibly be. Nobody could complain that it wasn't well designed or built. It was just right. Now, from the sounds of what Andy was saying, we know it's not just people who do vineyards that go to a huge amount of trouble. Richard will tell us, where are you, Richard? Come on, you're the farmer here. I mean, it takes a lot of trouble, doesn't it, to grow crops, to prepare the ground. There's an enormous amount of investment, loads of time and energy and money go into preparing the soil and planting the crops and protecting and watering and all the rest of it. In our story, but also in real life, farmers work really hard. And then the owner of this vineyard rented it to some tenants. Now, what that means, boys and girls, is that he, for whatever reason, had to go on a journey. So he said, listen, to some people that he knew, how about we do a deal? You come in and look after my vineyard. It's perfect. You've got it all laid out perfectly. Everything is ready to go. All you need to do is just make sure it's looked after and trimmed and growing and everything's going well. And at harvest time, I'll come or I'll send a servant and you can have some of the crop and I'll have some of the crop and everything's fine. That sounds fair enough, doesn't it? Don't you think that sounded fair enough? It was a good arrangement, actually. Everybody gets a deal. They didn't have a vineyard. Now they get some of one. He couldn't look after it or needed someone else to look after it, or at least was giving somebody else the privilege of looking after it, and that was all right. Actually, these tenants have got a huge privilege of being tenants on this farm. It's all been done for them. In fact, I don't imagine any other farmer would have gone to so much trouble. I imagine another farmer would just have said, there's the field, get on with it, and by the way, at the end, I'll collect some of the fruit. No, no, this farmer didn't treat them like that. It's all been done for them. All they need to do is keep their side of the agreement. Why on earth has Jesus told this parable? Because so far, so good. Everybody's happy. Can I say that it's worth spotting that this particular parable is in the middle of Mark's gospel? Now, Mark told a story to give an account of the life of the Lord Jesus. And Mark's gospel is in two really helpful halves. Chapters 1 to 8, the question keeps on being asked throughout Mark's gospel, who is this man? Who is this man? Who is this man? See all sorts of people asking that question, who is this man? People sitting in a boat with Jesus, who is this man that even the wind and the waves obey him? People healed of leprosy, who is this man that even evil spirits do what he says? People hearing him teach, saying, who is this man? Nobody teaches like this. Who's this man? And then from chapter 9 onwards, which is where we are, it's pretty obvious who he is. He is God's rescuer king. He's the one God promised to change the world, to rescue people, to bring people back to God. And the question from there on, from chapter 9, is what does it mean to know him, to follow him, to love him, to be rescued by him? But there's a problem, because here in chapter 12, there are some hugely religious people who just don't want to know. So he's telling them a story. It's worth just jumping back in the Bible for a minute to see that there's something special about this story. See, if we knew the Bible a bit better, we would have spotted what's special about this story. And these really religious people who he was telling the story to, well, they did know the Bible well. And they did spot what he was saying. Keep your finger in Mark chapter 12 and jump back with me to Isaiah chapter 5. Written about 600 or 700 years before Jesus was born. Page 484, if you're using one of these blue church Bibles. See, what they knew, and what you and I perhaps may not remember, is that all through the first half of the Bible, all through the Old Testament, God's people, people he loves and looks after, are described in picture language as a vineyard. Have a look at Isaiah chapter 5. And God says, through the prophet Isaiah, I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one has a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and he cleared it of stones, and he planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it, and he cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but that vineyard, it yielded only bad fruit. Now listen, you dwellers in Jerusalem, you men of Judah, you people who should know, in other words, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I've done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? And now I'll tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I'm going to take away its hedge. And it'll be destroyed. I'll break down its wall and it'll be trampled. I'll make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, where briars and thorns will grow there. I'll command the clouds not to rain in it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, God's people. And the men of Judah are the garden of his delight. And he looked for justice, but he saw bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but he heard cries of distress. Here in Mark chapter 12, these religious guys that Jesus is speaking to would have known what Isaiah said. And they would have sat there thinking, we don't believe you're the king. We don't believe you're God's rescuer. How dare you start talking to us about how God deals with vineyards? Because we know what you're doing. You're pointing at us. Of all the things Jesus could have said to these religious people, he's decided to tell them a parable about people caring for a vineyard, which in Isaiah's day, the religious leaders hadn't looked after. What on earth is Jesus doing? He's trying to get them to understand that they had wasted all the grace that God has given them, all the trouble that God has gone to, all the love that has been poured into them. Listen, you lot. Effectively, says Jesus, listen to what God has given you and what you've done with it. What does he say? Well, let's have a look. Verse 2. of chapter 12 of Mark. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized the servant and they beat him and they sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them and they struck him on the head and they treated him shamefully. And then they sent another and that one they killed. And he sent many others. Some of them they beat and others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him, and they threw him out of the vineyard. Do you know, Jesus' description in the second half of that parable is almost like working his way through the Old Testament of the Bible. Jesus says, listen, here is God's beautiful vineyard with all the richness and grace and goodness that he has prepared. And God simply is calling his people to say, don't rely on yourselves or on other gods. Rely on me, love me, respond to me, and you will know my blessing and love and future. Isaiah said it, and they rejected him. Jeremiah said it, and they rejected him. Ezekiel said it, and they didn't want to know him. In fact, if you trace your finger through the Bible, you will see lots and lots of servants of God came and went, and everyone they turned their back on, and they beat, and they killed, and they ignored, and eventually, everyone who told really religious people to turn back to God, to trust him rather than themselves or anyone else, ended up being rejected. And finally, the owner sent his son, and they recognized the opportunity to get it all for themselves, so they killed him. What's the owner of the vineyard going to do? Verse 9 of our passage. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and he'll kill those tenants and give it to some others. So ultimately, they got the justice they deserved. Now, you've got to say, that's a terrible story, actually. It's all about God's goodness being met by God's justice. But I wonder if you noticed, look again at verse 9, just at the very end. God, the owner of the vineyard, will give it to others. Jesus was telling these religious leaders that just like their forebears, the people that had gone before them, they hadn't lived up to the responsibility God had entrusted with them to them, so it would be given to others. If religious people can't enjoy God's grace and his goodness and his love and everything that he's been given because they want their own way, well, God's going to take his goodness and love and grace and give it to other people. And the big question here in Mark chapter 12 is, who are the other people? Any suggestions? Who are the other people? If the really religious ones wouldn't listen to God's grace, who are the other people? Any ideas? Anybody? Well, let's read it. The answer, actually, is you. If really, really, really religious people who think they've got it all sorted, who are far more worried about what they can do for God than what he can do for them, don't want to know his goodness and love, well, he'll take his goodness and love and give it to people who say, "I can do nothing for you, God, except rely on you." And actually, that is us. When reading a story in the Bible, we sometimes like, wrongly most of the time, to ask the question, how do I fit into this story? Well, actually, in this particular one, you and I fit into the story at the end of verse 9. We are the others. God will give all his love and goodness and grace to those who are willing to rely on him. Now, of course, you and I don't know anything about vineyards, do we? Well, most of us don't. Andy does, and I suspect Richard does, and there may be one or two others who know about growing vineyards, but most of us aren't. I'm a hopeless gardener. Genuinely hopeless. But it is a picture. a picture of what to do with the huge privilege God has given us of the opportunity to rely on him and know him. And maybe the very best bit of the parable is the last bit. And in the last bit, Jesus takes the picture not from fields and vineyards and things, but actually he takes it to buildings. Have a look with me at verse 10. "Haven't you read this scripture?" says Jesus. "The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. And the Lord has done this, and it's marvelous in your eyes." Have you ever been to a quarry? In a quarry, there are loads and loads of different stones of different shapes and sizes and weights and cracks and all that sort of thing. And I guess what happens when building a building out of stone is that the builders really want the nice square ones. So they load a whole lot of them and they take them to the building site and they start the building. But if in amongst the square ones there's a slightly odd-shaped one, it's not quite square, then when they're building that lovely wall in the first place, they might just say, "Nah, that one's no good, George, give it to somebody, put it aside." And then George will put it to one side, or whatever his name is. My builder happens to be called George. And they'll put it aside, and then they'll forget about it, I suppose, and build their nice wall. And as they build it up, and in those days they built the stone and they built the arches and they built the roof and they came to the very top, they discovered as they did it that there was a shape right at the top and they needed an odd shaped stone to hold the whole thing together. An odd shaped stone on which the arch on this side and the arch on this side would be able to rest. And they would remember. The stone that the builders rejected had become the capstone. Just the right shape, just the right size, just the right temper, just the right strength to hold the whole thing in place. Can you see? Just like the tenant farmers, the religious leaders, well, they did that with Jesus. They threw him away. They didn't want to know about him and all that he had to say. But actually, when you stop and think about it, he's the one that's just what they really needed. The one who could say to them, "Don't rely on yourselves, rely on what God has done." Who would say to everybody, "Don't rely on yourself, rely on what God has done. Rely on me. I'm the promised Savior, Rescuer, King." Well, it wasn't lost on the religious leaders. Look at their reaction in verse 12. "Then they looked for a way to arrest him, because they knew that he'd spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left and went away." Well, his time eventually came. And they did do what the tenant farmers did in the parable. They did reject him. And they did kill him. But stop and think for a moment. Here we are as those who every day receive the grace of God. The very fact that the sun shines, the very fact that we have air to breathe, the fact we have food available, clothes on our backs, good things to drink, that it's all a shout to us, isn't it, of the grace of God all the time, every day. We live under the grace of God. We live in a world that he's given us, enjoying the privileges that he's given us, of a world that is ordered. Remember that? From Genesis chapter 8, we've thought about it a lot these last few weeks. The order that God has put into the world, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will never cease. Now, we all know that it feels like our world is broken, but you know, we also know that it's nothing like as broken as it deserves to be. And we, who are recipients of his grace every day, we don't deserve any of it, actually, but he gives it to us anyway. And what we do all the time with grace is mostly to ignore it and finally to reject him. But what we need more than anything else is the one who will bring us back to God and rescue us from his wrath. And that's what Jesus has done. By being rejected, by dying on a cross, by taking the punishment that we deserve, not only does God give us his goodness every day, but he gives us a rescuer that will bring us back to him. And Jesus rising from the dead made it possible for us to know God forever. So here's the question. At harvest, as well as at every other day of the year, but at harvest, you and I have this reminder that God is good to us. May not feel that perhaps he's quite as good to you as it feels like you'd like him to be, but you know, the very fact we have the health and strength to be here is a witness that he is good to us. What are you going to do with that goodness? You think it's an accident? No. No, we're bearers of grace. What are we going to do with his grace? Walk away or say, thank you for giving me all that you have. And thank you that though I let you down, you sent Jesus to die for me, to rescue me. What are we going to do with grace? What have we done with grace? What will we do with the future? Or we can know him and love him and respond to him and thank him for his grace. And know all the more of it in the days to come. Let me encourage you, please, to do just that.